It was too late to visit the dean of Tuskegee, so I went to the bus station and boarded a bus for Atlanta, via Auburn, Alabama. The trip was without incident until we changed buses at Auburn. As always, we Negroes sat at the rear. Four of us occupied the back bench. A large, middle-aged Negro woman sat in front of us to the left. A young Negro man occupied the seat in front of us to the right. At one of the stops, two white women boarded and could find no place to sit. No gallant Southern white man or youth rose to offer them a place in the white section. The bus driver called back and asked the young Negro man and the middle-aged Negro woman to sit together so the white women could have one of the seats. Both ignored the request. We felt the tensions mount as whites craned to stare back at us. A red-headed white man in a sports shirt stood up, faced the rear, and called out to the Negro,
"Didn't you hear the driver? Move out, man."
"They're welcome to sit here," the Negro said quietly, indicating the empty seat beside him and the one beside the woman across the aisle. The driver looked dumbfounded and then dismayed. He walked halfway to the rear and, struggling to keep his voice under control, said,
"They don't want to sit with you people, don't you know that? They don't want to. Is that plain enough?"
We felt an incident boiling, but none of us wanted the young Negro, who had paid for his ticket, to be forced to vacate his seat. If the women did not want to sit with us, then let one of the white men offer his seat, and he could come and sit with us. The young Negro said no more. He gazed out the window. The redhead bristled.
"Do you want me to slap these two jigaboos out of their seats?"
he asked the driver in a loud voice. We winced and turned into mummies, staring vacantly, insulating ourselves against further insults.
"No, for God's sake, please, no rough stuff," the driver pleaded.
One of the white women looked toward us apologetically, as though she were sorry to be the cause of such a scene. "It's all right," she said. "Please," asking the driver and the young man to end their attempts to get her a seat. The redhead flexed his chest muscles and slowly took his seat, glaring back at us. A young teenager sitting halfway to the front sniggered.
"Man, he was going to slap that nigger all right."
The white bully was his hero, but other whites maintained a disapproving silence. At the Atlanta station, we waited for the whites to get off. One of them, a large, middle-aged man, hesitated, turned, and stepped back toward us. We hardened ourselves for another insult. He bent over to speak to the young Negro.
"I just wanted to tell you that before he slapped you, he'd have had to slap me down first," he said.
None of us smiled. We wondered why he had not spoken up while whites were still on the bus. We nodded our appreciation, and the young Negro said gently,
"It happens to us all the time." "Well, I just wanted you to know I was on your side, boy."
He winked, never realizing how he had revealed himself to us by calling our companion by the hated name of Boy. We nodded wearily in response to his parting nod. I was the last to leave the bus. An elderly white man, bald and square of build, dressed in worn blue work clothes, peered intently at me. Then he crimped his face as though I were odious and snorted,
"Phew!"
His small blue eyes shone with repugnance, a look of such unreasoning contempt for my skin that it filled me with despair. It was a little thing, but piled on all the other little things, it broke something in me. Suddenly, I had had enough. Suddenly, I could stomach no more of this degradation, not of myself, but of all men who were black like me. Abruptly, I turned and walked away. The large bus station was crowded with humanity. In the men's room, I entered one of the cubicles and locked the door. For a time, I was safe, isolated. For a time, I owned the space around me, though it was scarcely more than that of a coffin. In medieval times, men sought sanctuary in churches. Nowadays, for a nickel, I could find sanctuary in a colored restroom. Then, sanctuary had the smell of incense-permeated walls. Now, it had the odor of disinfectant. The irony of it hit me. I was back in the land of my forefathers, Georgia. The town of Griffin was named for one of them. Two, I, a Negro, carried the name hated by all Negroes, for former Governor Griffin, no kin that I would care to discover, devoted himself heroically to the task of keeping Negroes in their place. Thanks in part to his efforts, this John Griffin celebrated a triumphant return to the land from which his people had sprung by seeking sanctuary in a toilet cubicle at the bus station. I took out my cleansing cream and rubbed it on my hands and face to remove the stain. I then removed my shirt and undershirt, rubbed my skin almost raw with the undershirt, and looked into my hand mirror. I could pass for white again. I repacked my duffel, put my shirt and coat back on, and wondered how I could best leave the colored restroom without attracting attention. I guessed it was near midnight, but the traffic in and out remained heavy. Oddly, there was little of the easy conversation one generally hears in public restrooms. None of the laughter and woofing. I waited, listening to footsteps come and go, to the water sounds of hand-washing and flushing. Much later, when I heard no more footsteps, I stepped from my cubicle and walked toward the door that led into the main waiting room. I hurried into the crowd, unnoticed. The shift back to white status was always confusing. I had to guard against the easy, semi-obscene language that Negroes use among themselves, for coming from a white man, it is insulting. It was midnight. I asked a doorman where to find a room for the night. He indicated a neon sign that stood out against the night sky. YMCA, only a block or so away. I realized that though I was well-dressed for a Negro, my appearance looked shabby for a white man. He judged me by that and indicated a place where lodging was inexpensive. December 2nd. Telephone calls to the sepia office in Fort Worth. They asked me to do some more stories about Atlanta. My photographer, Don Rutledge, could not get there for 2 days. I telephoned the Trappist Monastery at Conyers, Georgia, about 30 miles away, and asked if they would receive me for a short visit. I felt the past weeks, the strange sickness that cried for a change, for some relief from the constant racial grind. I checked out of the Y and boarded the bus for Conyers. The driver had mastered one of the techniques of degrading the Negro. Every time a white person got off, the driver said politely, "Watch your step, please." But whenever a Negro approached the front to get off, the driver's silence fairly roared. His refusal to extend even this courtesy to passengers who had paid as much as any white for their tickets was so conspicuous it made me aware of the stirrings of resentment among the Negroes behind me. Nicely dressed, respectable Negro women, even the aged, could not draw from him the courteous warning, "Watch your step." The implication was eloquently clear and unmistakable. I watched, wondering at the uselessness of the man's bad manners. Then, at a stop, a group of whites walked to the front, and behind them a sedately dressed Negro woman in her 50s. I felt the driver's dilemma and was amused by it. Should he say, "Watch your step, please," when the statement would be addressed also to the Negro? "Watch your step, please," he finally said, opening the doors. The whites stepped down without response, but the Negro lady nodded politely to him and said, "Thank you. knowing full well his warning had not been meant for her. It was a moment of triumph. She proved herself more courteous than his white passengers, and more courteous than he, and she did it without the slightest sarcasm. The subtlety of it escaped the whites on the bus, but it in no way escaped the driver or the Negroes at the back. I heard stifled chuckles of approval from behind me. The driver slammed the doors harder than necessary and lurched the bus forward. I arrived at the Trappist monastery with its 2,000 acres of wood and farmlands, and entered the courtyard as the monks were chanting vespers. Their voices floated to me. A brown-robed brother led me to a cell on the second floor and informed me supper would be at 5. The contrast was almost too great to be borne. It was a shock, like walking from the dismal swamps into sudden brilliant sunlight. Here all was peace, all silence except for the chanted prayers. Here men know nothing of hatred. They sought to make themselves conform ever more perfectly to God's will, whereas outside I had seen mostly men who sought to make God's will conform to their wretched prejudices. Here men sought their center in God, whereas outside they sought it in themselves. The difference was transforming. We had supper at 5. Homemade bread, butter, milk, red beans, spinach, and a peach. At 6:30 we went into the chapel for the last prayers of the day. I knelt in the chapel balcony, looking down on 90 white-robed monks. When Compline was finished, they turned out most of the lights and chanted the solemn Salve Regina so beautifully, so tenderly, we felt the crusts of our lives fall away and we rested in the deep hush of eternity. When the last echoes died to silence, the monks filed out. Another day had ended for them. They went to bed at 7 and would get up to begin a new day in the morning at 2. The same thing has happened in Trappist monasteries throughout the centuries. I felt the timelessness of it, and I remained a long time alone in the darkened chapel, not praying, simply resting in the warmth where all senses are ordered into harmony, where hatred cannot penetrate. After my weeks of travel, when I had seen constantly the rawness of man's contempt for man, the mere act of resting in this atmosphere was healing. I went down the hall to take a shower and wash my clothes in the sink. As I returned to my cell, I found a monk, the guest master, who had come to see if I needed anything. We talked for a time, and I explained my research project to him. "Do Negroes often come here as guests to spend a few days, Father?" I asked. "Oh, yes," he said, "though I don't suppose many really know about this place." "This is the Deep South," I said. "When you have Negro guests, do you have any trouble with your white guests?" "No, no. The type of white man who would come to the Trappists, well, he comes here to be in an atmosphere of dedication to God. Such a man would hardly keep one eye on God and the other on the color of his neighbor's skin." We discussed the religiosity of the racists. I told him how often I had heard them invoke God, and then some passage from the Bible, and urge all who might be faltering in their racial prejudice to pray, brother, with all your heart, before you decide to let them niggers into our schools and cafes. The monk laughed. "Didn't Shakespeare say something about every fool in error can find a passage of Scripture to back him up?" He knew his religious bigots. I showed the priest the booklet on racial justice, For Men of Goodwill, written by a New Orleans priest, Robert Gusty, in which most of the questions and clichés about the Negro are discounted, particularly that God made the Negro dark as a curse. Father Gusty says, "No modern biblical scholar would subscribe to any such theory." The monk nodded. I insisted on the point. "Is there any place in the Bible that justifies it, even by a stretch of the imagination, Father?" "Biblical scholars don't stretch their imaginations, at least reputable ones don't," he said. "Will you wait a moment? I have something you must read." He returned almost immediately with the book Scholasticism and Politics by Jacques Maritain. "Maritain has some profound things to say about the religion of racists," he said, leafing the book. "You might review this page." He placed a cardboard marker at the page and handed the book to me. The monk bowed and left. I listened to the rustle of his thick robes as he walked down the hall in the tremendous silence. I then had a visit from a young college instructor of English, a born Southerner of great breadth of understanding. He told me that his more liberated views of the Negro were in such contradiction to those of his elders, his parents, and uncles, that he no longer went home to visit them. We talked until midnight. He invited me to go with him to visit Flannery O'Connor the next day, but I told him that since I had only a few hours, I felt I must spend them in the monastery. He left. The cell was cold. The Georgia countryside slept outside. Since I would be getting up at 2 to begin the day, I decided not to sleep. I felt the steam radiator with my hand. It was without a hint of warmth. The Maritain lay on the cot. I got into bed and opened the page the monk had marked. Speaking of the religiosity of racists, Maritain observes, "God is invoked, and he is invoked against the God of the spirit, of intelligence and love, excluding and hating this God. What an extraordinarily spiritual phenomenon this is. People believe in God and yet do not know God. The idea of God is affirmed and at the same time disfigured and perverted." He goes on to say that this kind of religion, which declines wisdom, even though it may call itself Christian, is in reality as anti-Christian as is atheism. I was startled that the French philosopher could so perfectly characterize the racists of our southern states. Then I realized that he was describing racists everywhere and from all times. That this is the religious trait of men who twist their minds to consider racial prejudice a virtue, whether it be a white citizens' council or Klan member, a Nazi Gauleiter, a South African white supremacist, or merely someone's aunt who says, "Nobody's worse than those Italians, or Spaniards, or Englishmen, or Danes, etc." I slept and woke up shouting from the old familiar nightmare of men and women closing in on me, shuffling toward me. I lay there, fully dressed, under the cell's bare globe, trembling. I felt myself flush with embarrassment at having disturbed the Trappist silence. Surely monks sleeping in other cells, their bodies exhausted from work in the fields and hours of prayers, heard me and lay awake, wondering. December 4th. This morning the young professor drove me back to Atlanta. Along the roadside, oaks were spectacularly red against the green of pines. In town, I registered at the Georgia Hotel, a luxury hotel, where I was treated with the utmost suspicion and discourtesy. Did the staff have doubts about my racial purity? Though I had bags and was well enough dressed, they made me pay in advance, and I could not make a phone call without their insisting I come down immediately to the desk and pay the dime. I had never encountered such obtuseness in a first-class hotel, and I told them so. This only increased their inhospitality. I decided not to stay. The Black Star photographer, Don Rutledge, arrived in his little Renault from Rockvale, Tennessee, around noon. We were to do a story together on Atlanta's Negro business and civic leaders, and perhaps some others. I liked him immediately. He is a tall, somewhat skinny young fellow, married and has a child, a gentleman in every way. December 7th. 3 days of hard work, from morning until late at night. My interview notebooks were filled up, but at night I was too tired to write in my journal and went immediately to bed. We had had the most splendid help and cooperation from such Negro leaders as Attorney A.T. Walden, Businessman T.M. Alexander, the Reverend Samuel Williams, and the immensely impressive Dr. Benjamin Mays, president of Morehouse, also many others. I had arrived in Atlanta feeling that the situation for the Negro in the South was utterly hopeless, due to the racists' powerful hold on the purse strings of whites and Negroes alike, and due to the lack of unanimity among Negroes. But Atlanta changed my mind. Atlanta has gone far in proving that the problem can be solved, and in showing us the way to do it. Though segregation and discrimination still prevail and still work a hardship, great strides have been made, strides that must give hope to every observer of the South. At least three factors are responsible. First and most important, the Negroes have united in a common goal and purpose, and Atlanta has more men of leadership quality than any other city in the South, men of high education, long vision, and great dynamism. Second, as one of the leaders, Mr. T.M. Alexander, explained to me, though the state of Georgia has never had an administration sympathetic to the Negro cause, the city of Atlanta has long been favored with an enlightened administration under the leadership of Mayor William B. Hartsfield. Third, the city has been blessed by a newspaper, the Atlanta Constitution, that is not afraid to take a stand for right and justice. Its most noted columnist and now publisher, Ralph McGill, Pulitzer Prize winner, is significantly referred to as Rastus by the white citizens' councils. In the South, where most newspapers, even the great metropolitan dailies, have shown themselves short-sighted and uncourageous, or worse, have propagandized as though they were organs of the councils and clans, the importance of those newspapers that live up to their journalistic responsibilities cannot be sufficiently emphasized. A handful of the latter, headed by such men as Mark Etheridge, Hodding Carter, Easton King, Harry Golden, P.D. East, and Ralph McGill, plus a few others, have stood up for the freedoms of all men. McGill and his colleagues gamble their fortunes and their reputations on the proposition that it is journalism's sacred trust to find and publish the truth and that the majority, if properly informed, will act for the good of the community and the country. The great danger in the South comes precisely from the fact that the public is not informed. Newspapers shirk notoriously their editorial responsibilities and print what they think their readers want. They lean with the prevailing winds and employ every fallacy of logic in order to editorialize harmoniously with popular prejudices. They also keep a close eye on possible economic reprisals from the councils and the clans, plus other super-patriotic groups who bring pressures to bear on the newspaper's advertisers. In addition, most adhere to the long-standing conspiracy of silence about anything remotely favorable to the Negro. His achievements are carefully excluded, or when they demand attention, they are handled with the greatest care to avoid the impression that anything good the individual Negro does is typical of his race. We spent our time, significantly, between the three-block section on Auburn Street, where Negro financing and industry controls some $80 million, and the section of the six Negro colleges. A close parallel exists between the two, for most of the business leaders are connected with the schools of higher learning, either as teachers or directors. In addition, all of these men are religious leaders in the community. As Alexander stated, "If we know anything, it is that if virtues do not equal powers, the powers will be misused." About 25 years ago, two men came to Atlanta to teach in the university system. Both were economists. They found Atlanta a thriving intellectual center for the Negro. In the slave years, any attempt at literacy among Negroes was severely punished. In some communities, a Negro's right hand was mutilated if he learned to read and write. The Negro therefore prized education as the only doorway into the world of knowledge and dignity to which he aspired. The climate was right to begin a program that would lead them to economic respectability. L.D. Milton and J.B. Blayton, the two economists, recognized that so long as the Negro had to depend on white banks to finance his projects for improvement and growth, he was at the mercy of the white man. They recognized that economic emancipation was the key to the racial solution. So long as the race had to depend on a basically hostile source of financing, it would not advance, since the source would simply refuse loans for any project that did not meet with its approval. These two men said, in essence, "Let everyone in the community pool what little resources he has with others." By uniting the small power of small sums, by skillfully manipulating it, they could achieve a consolidated financial power. This action resulted in the founding of two banks in Atlanta. Recently, I discovered, an instance arose where the Negro leaders used their economic leverage in a typical manner. It became necessary for the Negro community to expand its physical limits. An area of white residences served as a bottleneck. The housing committee met, and Negroes and whites alike agreed to have Negroes purchase this block of homes. The white lending agencies, however, refused to make the loans. As usual, the Negro leaders called a meeting to discuss what might be done. They agreed to set aside a large sum of money from which applicants could make loans to buy these houses. After four such loans were made, the white lending agencies called and said, "Don't take all that business away from us. How about letting us handle a few of those loans?" Business that had been refused a few days previously was now welcomed. But though financing is the key, other elements are no less important. Education, housing, job opportunities, and the vote enter the picture of any improving community. The Negro leader, the successful man in Atlanta, is deeply imbued with a sense of responsibility toward his community. This is true of the doctors, the lawyers, the educators, the religious leaders, and the businessmen. "There is no big me and little you," T.M. Alexander, one of the founders of the Southeastern Fidelity Fire Insurance Company, said. "We must pool all of our resources, material and mental, to gain the respect that will enable all of us to walk the streets with the dignity of American citizens." In the matter of education, Atlanta has long been eminent. With men of the quality of Benjamin Mays, president of Morehouse, and Rufus Clement, president of Atlanta University, to mention only two who are world-renowned, the intellectual climate is of high quality. The most impressive proof of this is found in the classrooms, where teachers and students face squarely the problems that haunt this country, particularly the race problem. I visited the sociology class of Spelman College, where Dr. Moreland, Mrs. Charles Moreland, bullied and taunted and challenged her class to think and talk. This handsome and brilliant young woman, like her students, despises the idea that in America any man has to earn his rights to first-class citizenship. But she and her colleagues believe, on the other hand, that every citizen has to live up to his duties of citizenship. In the classes I attended, one of the students was assigned to take the role of the white racist and to argue his points to the other students. It was a brutal and revealing session. The comparison between them and the white racists was cruel indeed. The students have better manners, more learning, more courtesy, and infinitely more understanding. Every leader is interested in better housing. Many professional men, particularly doctors like F. Earl McClendon, have developed residential areas as their contribution to the cause. Atlanta has virtually miles and miles of splendid Negro homes. They have destroyed the cliché that whenever Negroes move into an area, the property values go down. In every instance, they have improved the homes they have bought from the whites and built even better ones. The philosophy here is simple. Try to anchor as many Negroes as possible in their own homes. The fourth element, the vote, the right of the governed to govern themselves, has long been a cherished goal of all thinking men of Atlanta. Every business, professional, and civic leader is also a leader in politics. In 1949, the The Democrats, under A.T. Walden, and the Republicans, under John Wesley Dobbs, united to form the Atlanta Negro Voters League, and the Negro began to have a voice in his government. It has become an increasingly important and responsible one. By 1955, this type of political action helped elect Atlanta University President Rufus E. Clement to the city school board, making him the first Negro to hold elective office in Georgia since the Reconstruction. All take into account the cooperation of a fair-minded city administration under the leadership of Mayor Hartsfield. Almost alone among politicians of the South, Mayor Hartsfield has not sunk to the level of winning votes at the Negro's expense. He has proved the point that a man can, after all, stand up for justice and constitutional law and still not sacrifice his political career. Benjamin Mays, J.B. Blayton, L.D. Milton, A.T. Walden, John Wesley Dobbs, Norris Herndon of the Atlantic Life Insurance Company, banker-druggist C.R. Yates, W.J. Shaw, E.M. Martin, Reverend Samuel Williams, Reverend William Holmes Borders, Reverend H.I. Bearden, Reverend Martin Luther King Sr. and his son Martin Luther King Jr., each has contributed and continues to contribute to the American dream in its best sense. I recall scenes picked at random. The look of growing concern and perhaps humiliation on photographer Don Rutledge's face as we moved from one scene to another. Concern and humiliation to realize that these men, these scenes, these ideals were unknown to most Americans and utterly beyond the comprehension of the Southern racist. It was a look, however, overspread with delight. The look of surprise and vast amusement on Dr. Benjamin Mays's intelligent face when I confided to him my journey as a Negro. At Spelman College, hearing Rosalind Pope play magnificently the Bach Toccata in D, and then the strange, bewildered expression on her face when she told me about arriving in Paris to spend a year studying piano, the strangeness of living in a great city where she could attend concerts to her fill, where she could walk into any door where she was a human being first and last, and not dismissed as a Negro. The evening in T.M. Alexander's home, the talk with his wife and his brilliant children. We realize that we have to run just to keep up. They are intent, like the other members of the community, upon doing everything within their power to nullify the picture of the loud, the brassy, the pushy, and successful Negro. The long talk with the Reverend Samuel Williams in his living room, a forceful man, but quiet, a fine intellect. Professor of philosophy. I spent years, he told me, studying the phenomenon of love. And I spend years studying the phenomenon of justice. At base, we spend years studying the same thing. It was time to return to New Orleans. My assignments in Atlanta with Rutledge were finished. He was anxious to get back to his wife and child. I asked him if he knew a first-rate photographer in New Orleans, since I wanted to go back over the terrain again as a Negro and have photos made. The project fascinated him, and we arranged to drive to New Orleans together so he could photograph it. December 9th. In New Orleans, I resumed my Negro identity, and we went to all of my former haunts to photograph them. Getting photos proved a problem. A Negro being photographed by a white arouses suspicions. Whites tended to wonder, what Negro celebrity is he? And to presume I was uppity. It equally aroused the curiosity of the Negroes. The Uncle Toms think that every Negro should bury his head in the sand and pretend he is not there. They distrust any Negro prominent enough to be photographed by a white photographer. Others feared I might be an Uncle Tom going over to the white side. We had to arrange to be at the same spot at the same time, but pretended to have no relationship. Rutledge appeared to be simply another tourist taking photos, and I just happened to be in them. One day we got some unexpected help. He approached a fruit stand in the French Market and began taking photographs. I walked up from another direction and bought some walnuts and an apple. An elderly and civil woman waited on me while another woman talked to him some distance away. She said,
"Why don't you hurry up and get a picture of that funny old nigger before he leaves?"
Rutledge said he believed he would, and I, pretending to be unaware of the plot, obliged by hanging around the fruit stalls. An hour later we went into the fish market. I showed interest in buying a fish, and at that moment Rutledge walked up and asked the vendor if he minded being photographed with some of the fish. The vendor was delighted. He left me standing at the counter and went to pose with a giant fish in his hand. I followed, pretending to think this was the fish he would sell me. Trying not to be impolite to me, he nevertheless maneuvered every possible way to keep me out of the pictures, and finally, when I stuck close to him, he became irritated and told me customers weren't allowed behind the counter. Then, when Rutledge said,
"That's good right there. Hold it,"
the man faced front and gave his most winning smile. A nod from Rutledge told me we had enough pictures, so I drifted away and out the door. We returned to the shoe stand, where we had no problem since my old partner Sterling Williams was intelligent and knowledgeable. Otherwise, we had to take the pictures quickly and disappear before a crowd gathered and began to ask questions. The experience had subtler points that did not escape Rutledge. Having a Negro for a companion took him inside the problem. He could avail himself of any restroom, any water fountain, any cafe for a cup of coffee, but he could not take me with him. Needless to say, he was too much of a gentleman to do this, and there were times when we went without that cup of coffee or that glass of water. December 14th. Finally, the photos were taken, the project concluded, and I resumed for the final time my white identity. I felt strangely sad to leave the world of the Negro after having shared it so long, almost as though I were fleeing my share of his pain and heartache. December 15th, Mansfield, Texas. I sat in the jet this afternoon, flying home from New Orleans, and looked out the window to the patterns of a December countryside far below. And I felt the greatest love for this land and the deepest dread of the task that now lay before me, the task of telling truths that would make me and my family the target of all the hate groups. But for the moment, the joyful expectation of seeing my wife and children again after 7 weeks overwhelmed all other feelings. When the plane landed, I hurried to collect my bags and walk out front. The car soon arrived, with children waving and shouting from the windows. I felt their arms around my neck, their hugs, and the marvelous jubilation of reunion. And in the midst of it, the picture of the prejudice and bigotry from which I had just come flashed into my mind, and I heard myself mutter, "My God, how can men do it when there are things like this in the world?" The faces of my wife and mother spoke their relief that it was over. That night was a festival. The country was aromatic with late autumn, with the love of family, with a return to light and affection. We talked little about the experience. It was too near, too sore. We talked with the children about the cats and the farm animals. January 2nd. Mr. Levitan, the owner of Sepia, called and asked me to come in for an editorial conference with Mrs. Jackson. Though the magazine had paid for the trip, and I in turn promised them some articles about it, he gave me the opportunity to back out. "It'll cause trouble," he said. "We don't want to see you killed. What do you think? Hadn't we better forget the whole thing?" "Do you mean you're willing to cancel this, after all you've been led to expect?" I asked. "The only way I'll run it is if you insist," he said. "Then I think we must run it," I said, wishing with all my heart I could drop it. However, Sepia, unlike many magazines, is widely read in the Deep South by Negroes. I felt it was the best way of letting them know that their condition was known, that the world knew more about them than they suspected, the best way to give them hope. The world would know then, in early March. It was January. I had 2 months left in which to work before the storm would break. February 26th. The time drew to a close. The news became known. I had spent weeks at work, studying, correlating statistics, going through reports, none of which actually helped to reveal the truth of what it is like to be discriminated against. They cancel truth almost more than they reveal it. I decided to throw them away and simply publish what happened to me. A call from Hollywood. Paul Coates spoke to me, asked me to fly out and be on his interview program. I accepted. March 14th. The first of the Coates shows was televised locally after it had been given heavy publicity over the weekend by the newspapers. I think almost every TV viewer in the area watched the show. When the program was finished and we heard Paul Coates announce we would return tomorrow to continue the interview, our attention switched to the telephone. We realized that now our neighbors knew. Now the whole Dallas-Fort Worth area knew. The phone began to ring. I picked it up, wondering what I should say if it were an abusive call. It was Penn and L.A. Jones from Midlothian. They talked for a long time. I realized that they were tying up the line so that no hate calls could come through. Finally, after almost an hour, we said goodbye. Immediately, my parents called to say it was fine. How full of dread their voices were, but they sincerely approved of what I had said. After that, silence. We sat and waited, but the phone did not ring. The silence was so unnatural, so ominous, it weighed heavy on us. Were none of my friends, no other members of my family going to call? March 17th. Flew to New York 2 days ago. Interview this morning with Time magazine in their new offices. They took photos and treated me with great cordiality. While I was at Time, the Dave Garraway show called. We were to have a preliminary interview that afternoon at 5. Unable to bear the silence from home, I returned to my room and telephoned to Mansfield. As a result of the two Paul Coates shows, my mother had received her first threatening call. It was from a woman who would not identify herself. The conversation had begun politely enough. The woman said they could not understand in town how I could turn against my own race. My mother assured her I had done this precisely for my race. The woman said, "Well, he's just thrown the door wide open for those niggers, and after we've all worked so hard to keep them out." She then became abusive and succeeded in terrorizing my mother by telling her, "If you could just hear what they're planning to do to him if he ever comes back to Mansfield." "Who's planning?" my mother asked. "That's all right. You just ought to be over at Curry's," a local cafe and night spot on the highway leading into Mansfield, run by ardent segregationists. "You'd see to it he never showed his face in Mansfield again." My mother said she felt better when I talked to her. She had never been confronted with this sort of brutality before. She called my wife over and they sat together, frightened. Then they called Penn Jones, who came immediately and placed himself at their disposition. Sickened that they would pick on a man's mother and strike at him through terrorizing her, I immediately made calls and asked for police surveillance of both my home and my parents' home. March 18th. Garraway was immensely impressive. When we finally met this morning, briefly, before I went on camera, I told him I was afraid that my appearance would bring severe repercussions against him from the South. He stood large, much larger than he appears on the screen. I told him I would answer his questions as carefully as possible. He bent over me and said, "Mr. Griffin, John, let me just ask you to do one thing." I braced myself against his request, fearing he would ask me to soft pedal. Just tell the truth as honestly and as frankly as you can, and don't worry about my sponsors or anything else. You keep your mind clear to answer whatever I ask. Will you forget everything else and just remember that? I looked at him with a resurgence of faith in a public figure. He kept me on camera 20 minutes, and he asked pointed questions that did not evade the issue. Before the interview was over, we were both deeply moved. At the end, he asked me about discrimination in the North. I told him I was not competent to answer. I told him that the Southern racist invariably brought up the point that things aren't perfect in the North either, which is no doubt so, as though that fact justified his injustices in the South. March 23rd. It was a busy weekend. I spent more and more time in my room between interviews and conferences with Mr. Levitan and our PR man, Ben Hall, while Mr. Levitan had a constant stream of visitors in his suite. On Tuesday, I did a TV documentary with Harry Golden. The Mike Wallace Show went on that evening, and then a long radio interview on the Long John Show from midnight until 4:30 in the morning. I got no sleep. Ben Hall offered me tranquilizers, but I did not dare take one for fear it would put me out completely. The Time article would be out that evening. I was anxious to see how they would treat the story, but I was most nervous about the Mike Wallace Show, and told Ben Hall that if Wallace asked just one wrong question, I would get up and walk out. He assured me Wallace would be sympathetic, but I had strong reservations. I particularly feared he would get embroiled in a religious discussion, bring in my Roman Catholicism in a way that could embarrass the church. The Golden Show went all right. It was easy, with the director taking pains to keep it informal and to encourage me. I got off to a bad start, but we did it over and it came out all right. Then in the evening, Ben Hall came to pick me up. We took a taxi to Mike Wallace's office, stopping at the corner of Broadway and 14th to pick up a copy of Time. It was around 8 o'clock and the streets were wet under a drizzling rain. Ben left me in a cigar stand and ran across the street to get the magazine. In a moment, he returned with 2 copies. The story was good. They had told it right and straight. Relieved, we walked to Wallace's office. When they showed us in, Wallace rose from his chair behind the desk and shook hands. I was surprised to find him so much more youthful in appearance than I had imagined, but he looked also tired and uncomfortable. He offered me a seat and, without pretense, asked if I wanted to see the questions he planned to ask me. I told him no. He appeared to know that I viewed him cautiously and that I was not enthusiastic about this interview. He fumbled uncomfortably for words, and I took a liking to him. From the hints he dropped, "We've investigated you pretty thoroughly." I was aghast. He knew things about the trip, the names of people I had stayed with, many things I had tried to hide in order to protect the people involved. "Please," I pleaded, "don't mention those names on the air. I'd be afraid their lives would be endangered, and they were my friends." "Hell, I'm not going to do a damn thing to hurt them," he said. "Look, I'm on your side." "How did you find out about all of this?" I asked. "Oh, it's part of the business," he said. We sat in his office, both of us dull, both of us tired to death. Our talk frittered out. He asked how the Coates shows went. Said he heard they were excellent. "That makes me want to do better," he said. "He had a full hour. You've only got a half hour," I said. He pulled a bottle of whiskey out of his desk, offered me a drink. I refused. "Look, John, hell, I know you've done nothing but answer questions on all these shows and newspaper interviews, but will you pull yourself together and really work for me tonight?" "I do that as a matter of conscience anyway," I said. "You want me to tell you something?" he said. "I'm scared to death of you. I mean, a man who'd do what you've done." "Then you don't know me as well as I thought you did," I said. "The truth is, I'm scared to death of you." He burst out laughing. "Well, I guarantee you, you've got no reason to be." Liveliness returned. Both of us felt certain it would go well. We walked out onto a stage that contained only two chairs and a smoking stand. The camera technicians and director prepared us, got cables out of sight, strapped mics on our necks, shouted instructions. Wallace smoked incessantly and smiled at me while yelling oaths in answer to yelled instructions. "Remember," he said, "we've got to do as well in a half hour as you did with Paul in an hour." "I'll talk fast," I said, peering past the lights into the camera jumble of darkness. The count started. The red lights came on. Wallace talked and smoked. He poured intelligent questions into me and kept his face close, absorbing my attention, encouraging me. It was a supercharged moment. I answered, forgetting everything except him and his questions. Fatigue disappeared. Fascination took over. The excitement sustained us. I realized when the time was up that it had gone well. And when we went off the air, Wallace shouted, "Top notch! Cancel everything and schedule it immediately!" It was an extraordinary experience. Never have I been handled more superbly by an interviewer. April 1st. Radio-Télévision Française flew a crew of five from Paris to do a television show of the person-to-person type at my home in Mansfield. We had three busy days with Pierre Dumayet, the commentator, and Claude Lurset, the director of the Cinq Colonnes à la Une. I put them on the plane out of here yesterday evening, and only then had time to settle down to some work. But work was difficult. The story had circulated all over the world, and mail, telegrams, and telephone calls poured in. The local situation was odd. I had no contact with anyone in town, and no one had contact with me. However, I understood that I was loudly discussed in the stores and on the streets, that the druggist and a couple of others had risen to my defense when the discussions became hot. I avoided going downtown, going into any of the stores, for fear my presence would embarrass people who had been my friends. The local roadside cafe, a gathering place for the segregationists, had a new sign. For some time, it had carried a sign reading, "We don't serve Negroes." Then this was replaced by a larger sign, "Whites only." Now another had joined it, "No albinos allowed." This sign that so disgusted my parents greatly amused me. I was surprised and pleased to discover that Foy Curry, the cafe owner, was, after all, a man of some wit. The principal point of contention among the women of the town appeared to be whether or not I had done a Christian thing. I feel that though few of them liked it, at least a large proportion of them understood that I worked as much for them and their children as I did for the Negroes. Certainly my mail thus far was overwhelmingly congratulatory. I began to hope that I had been overly pessimistic, that we might be able to live in Mansfield in an atmosphere of peace and understanding after all. April 2nd. The phone woke me in the morning. I glanced out our front window to a calm spring landscape of fields and woods, then picked up the phone. A long-distance call from the Star Telegram in Fort Worth. What could they want, I wondered, since they had not carried one word about my story. The reporter came on the line. He cautiously asked me how things were. "All right as far as I know," I said. "You don't sound too excited," he said. I began to feel uneasy. Why should I be?
"You mean you haven't heard?"
"What?"
"You were hanged in effigy from the center red light wire downtown on Main Street this morning."
"In Mansfield?" I asked.
"That's right."
He told me that the Star Telegram had received an anonymous call that racists had hanged my effigy on Main Street. The newspaper checked it out with a local constable who confirmed that a dummy, half black, half white, with my name on it and a yellow streak painted down its back, was hanging from the wire.
"What would you like to say about it?" the reporter asked.
"I'm sorry it happened," I said. "It'll only give the town a worse name."
"People seem pretty excited about what you've done. There's a lot of loose talk out in Mansfield. Do you think this represents a real threat?"
I'd probably be the last to know, I said. Do you think your life's in danger? I have no idea. What are you going to do about this hanging? Ignore it. You're not even going downtown to see it? No, this sort of thing is not interesting, I said. Do you think this represents the prevailing sentiment around town? No, I'm sure it doesn't. The reporter thanked me for my answers. He said they had sent a photographer out to take a picture of the effigy. The reporter called back. He wondered, as I did, how this could have happened on Main Street when we are supposed to have police on duty all night. He told me that a grocer saw the effigy around 5 a.m. when he came to work, called the constable, and told him to get that damn thing down from there. The constable had taken it down and thrown it under the town junk heap, but when the reporter and photographer got to Mansfield, someone had retrieved the effigy from the dump and hung it on a sign reading, $25 fine for dumping dead animals. The local people remained utterly silent. I waited for just one, anyone, to call and say, "We may not approve of your views, but we think this hanging is shameful." Their silence was eloquent and devastating. My disappointment grew as the afternoon passed. Did their silence condone the lynching? My family's uneasiness approached terror now. My parents and my wife's mother begged us to take the children and go away somewhere until this thing blew over. That evening, the Star-Telegram carried a 6-column banner front-page headline announcing the lynching in effigy. Margaret Ann Turner, Mrs. Deckard Turner, had heard the news on TV and called from Dallas to say they were coming after the children. We telephoned the Joneses at Midlothian and then called the Turners back. Deckard said we must come and stay with them as long as there was the slightest danger. The Joneses also invited us, but they felt it might be better if we were in Dallas, since I had much support there, according to them. At such times, the slightest kindness on the part of anyone becomes a sort of bravery. My dad, who had gone to town, defiantly, I imagine, returned almost jubilant. He had gone into the grocery store where he usually trades and heard the sudden silence. Then one of the owners, in the back at the meat counter, called a greeting. "I didn't know whether I was still welcome," Dad said. "Hell, you know better than that," the grocer shouted. "I don't know. The way people have been acting, I was afraid if they saw me coming into your store, they might stop trading here." "That's the kind of customer we don't want in the first place," the grocer said. In the context of the day, this was heroism. Someone in town dared to express an opinion. The time came to take my wife and children to Dallas. Deckard Turner had called again and told me to bring my typewriter and current work. "We've fixed you up an office here at the Bridwell Library," he said, referring to the library of the Southern Methodist University Perkins School of Theology. "I'm not going to do it. Somebody's sure to find out, and they'll make a squawk about SMU offering me protection. I'm too unpopular. I don't want to get you or them into any uncomfortable situation." He insisted. He said they would be honored to offer me any hospitality and library or research facilities. They even requested I lecture to the student body. On my way out of the lane that leads from my parents' place to my home, the neighbors at the halfway point waved. But those near the highway, people with whom we had been cordial, gave me the most violently hostile stare. I ran the gauntlet driving through town. At the second red light, a truck pulled up beside me, and a young man in a cowboy hat looked down into the cab of my car. He told me he'd heard talk that they were planning to come and castrate me, that the date had been set. He said this coldly, without emotion, neither threatening nor sympathetic, exactly the way one would say, "The weatherman's promising rain for tomorrow." I stared up at him, not recognizing him, and felt my face flush with the embarrassment of being a public spectacle. After he drove on, I felt sure he meant to imply that someone from out of town, not a local group, planned this. When I got home, the suitcases were packed. My wife's mother said people in town thought the effigy hanging was the work of outsiders. I told her I had no way of knowing, but would certainly like to believe it. April 7th. The Star-Telegram carried an excellent and accurate story as a follow-up to the effigy hanging. It made things clear, it clarified motives, and it certainly lifted the entire matter above segregation and desegregation. Yet we learned that they burned a cross just above our house at the Negro school, and that someone remarked they should have burned it on my land. I wish they had. I wish they had. It would have been far better than burning it at the school. The Turners crowded us into their house. The relief to be there, surrounded by friends, away from the hostility and the threats of the bullies and castrators, was so great that we were suddenly filled with exhaustion. April 11th. We returned to Mansfield, deciding to hide away no longer. The mail poured in, hearteningly favorable and moving. Most people in other areas, including the Deep South, understood, though the situation remained uncomfortable at home. Our townspeople wanted to keep things peaceful at all costs. They said I had stirred things up. This is laudable and tragic. I, too, say let us be peaceful, but the only way to do this is first to assure justice. By keeping peaceful in this instance, we end up consenting to the destruction of all peace, for so long as we condone injustice by a small but powerful group, we condone the destruction of all social stability, all real peace, all trust in man's good intentions toward his fellow man. June 19th, Father's Day. There were 6,000 letters to date, and only 9 of them abusive. Many favorable letters came from Deep South states, from the whites. This confirmed my contention that the average Southern white is more properly disposed than he dares allow his neighbor to see, that he is more afraid of his fellow white racist than he is of the Negro. Justice Bach sent me a copy of his controversial speech at Radcliffe. He put it clearly. I am an angry old man about racial segregation. I live in a city where 25% of the population is Negro, and I doubt that the percentage is much higher, except in spots, in the 11 Civil War states. I am angry at being told I cannot understand the problem. I do not believe that it takes a genius to pierce to the heart of a situation to which Southern chivalry once gave, among other things, the mulatto. The cry about lack of understanding and the need for time to work things out are only excuses to do little or nothing about them, and for almost 100 years this served the South very well. With all of the pious talk against communism, the present conflict over integration is doing the work of the communists almost better than they could do it themselves. This is to our shame when we should be sharpening and perfecting our procedures. It is only a mixture of ignorance and conceit that leads one section of the country to assume that no human beings on earth but themselves can understand the conditions under which they live. I am annoyed by those who love mankind but are cruel and discourteous to people. Curtis Bach, Justice of the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, speech at Radcliffe College commencement, 1960. I worked all afternoon and then went home and took a cold shower. Returning to my office in the evening, the desolation of a little town on a frightfully hot Sunday struck me. And it struck me, too, that no one there forgets. No one there forgives. I ran the lines of disapproval every time I drove through town to my office at the edge of the woods. This afternoon, the town had been deserted except for the loafers who stood around the filling station on the street corners. All of them eyed me with animosity. Teenage boys in their jeans lounged against building fronts. They stared. One of the town citizens who had been cordial to me drove up and stopped beside me at the red light. I waved. He looked grimly away, not wanting the loungers to see him make a friendly gesture, not wanting them to carry tales. I smelled the sun-softened asphalt, smelled the summer odors of clover, swallowed the rebuff, and drove on. But I found myself looking down the country lane that leads to the barn, checking to make certain no one's car blocked the path. The lane was clear, but the neighbors were out in their yard. The woman stared hard at her feet. The husband lifted his head from weeding and glared at me as I drove past. I fixed my gaze on the sandy ruts and looked neither to right nor left. I had tried nodding too many times. In my rear-view mirror, I saw them after I had passed. Saw them stand there like statues, peering after me through the fog of pink dust raised by my wheels. August 14th. It was late in the afternoon of a cloudy, humid day. My parents, unable to bear the hostility, had sold their home and all their furniture and left for Mexico, where they hoped to find a new life. We, too, were going, since we had decided that it was too great an injustice to our children to remain. But I felt I must remain a while longer, until the bullies had a chance to carry out their threats against me. I could not allow them to say they had chased me out. They had promised to fix me on July 15th, and now they said they would do it August 15th. Across the pastures, the incredible vulgarity of highly amplified hillbilly music drifted from the cafe on the highway. I sat in the barren studio where I had worked so many years, emptied now of all except the table and the typewriter and the bed, stripped of its sheets, with only the mattress ticking, staring up at the ceiling. Empty bookshelves surrounded me. A few yards away, my parents' house stood equally empty. I wandered back and forth from my barn to the house. August 17th. I stayed on, and the lane leading to my barn office remained empty. They did not come for me. I hired a Negro youth to come and help me clean up my parents' house so it would be spotless for the new owners. The youth knew me and had no reticence in talking since he was sure I was one of them, so to speak. Both Negroes and whites have gained this certainty from the experiment. Because I was a Negro for 6 weeks, I remained partly Negro, or perhaps essentially Negro. While we swept and burned old newspapers, we talked.
"Why do the whites hate us? We don't hate them," he asked.
We had a long conversation during which he brought out the obvious fact that whites teach their children to call them niggers. He said this happened to him all the time, and that he would not even go into white neighborhoods because it sickened him to be called that. He said revealing things.
"Your children don't hate us, do they?"
"God, no," I said. "Children have to be taught that kind of filth. We'd never permit ours to learn it."
"Dr. Cook's like that. His little girl called me nigger, and he told her if he ever heard her say that again, he'd spank her till she couldn't sit down."
The Negro does not understand the white any more than the white understands the Negro. I was dismayed to see the extent to which this youth exaggerated. How could he do otherwise? The feelings of the whites toward Negroes. He thought they all hated him. The most distressing repercussion of this lack of communication has been the rise in racism among Negroes, justified to some extent, but a grave symptom nevertheless. It only widens the gap that men of goodwill are trying desperately to bridge with understanding and compassion. It only strengthens the white racist's cause. The Negro who turns now, in the moment of near realization of his liberties, and bares his fangs at a man's whiteness, makes the same tragic error the white racist has made. And it is happening on a wider scale. Too many of the more militant leaders are preaching Negro superiority. I pray that the Negro will not miss his chance to rise to greatness, to build from the strength gained through his past suffering, and above all, to rise beyond vengeance. If some spark does set the keg afire, It will be a senseless tragedy of ignorant against ignorant. Injustice answering injustice. A holocaust that will drag down the innocent and right-thinking masses of human beings. Then we will all pay for not having cried for justice long ago.